persecuted but still resisting, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. In Venezuela, being a member of the opposition means risking arrest. We asked this opposition lawmaker to tell us how she feels today.
Perseguida y resistiendo ante los embates de una dictadura.
Persecuted, she said, but resisting in the face of dictatorship. Also, White House advisor Jared Kushner is working on a peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians. Experts say it's probably dead on arrival.
It's just hard, given this administration's track record, to see any way in which this succeeds.
Plus, a cappella singers hit Moscow for an international competition, including these singing cops from Siberia. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Crowds gathered in the streets of the Venezuelan capital Caracas last night as secret police surrounded the vice president of the national parliament. Edgar Zambrano is a high-profile opposition leader. He'd just gotten into his car as agents swooped in to apprehend him. Zambrano refused to get outside of his vehicle, so police towed his car with him inside to a notorious Caracas prison. For reaction to this bizarre incident, we reached out to one of Zambrano's colleagues, National Assembly Deputy Adriana Pichardo in Caracas. Our editor, William Troop, was on hand to translate. I asked Pichardo what she made of Zambrano's arrest.
La aprehensión ilegal, absolutamente ilegal, el día de ayer del primer vicepresidente de la Asamblea Nacional, Edgar Zambrano.
The action that took place yesterday with the arrest of Edgar Zambrano was absolutely illegal, and it's part of a pattern of persecution by the government against the opposition and against lawmakers in the National Assembly, using the only power that the government still has functioning, which is the power of the judicial branch. But it is not legal, has no legal basis for taking that action. Yesterday we saw the arrest of Mr. Zambrano, but there are also plans to arrest 9 other lawmakers, and I just want to emphasize that this is not a legal action.
Do we know where Edgar Zambrano was taken? I mean, where is he now?
Sí, vicepresidente Edgar Zambrano lo tienen literalmente secuestrado.
Vice President Zambrano is literally being held hostage. He was kidnapped and taken to the jail of the political police here in Caracas, which is called the Helicoide prison.
Has he been able to see a lawyer?
No. Precisamente en la dictadura que vivimos en Venezuela.
No, he has not had access to legal counsel. And that is one of the things that happens in this dictatorship that we have in Venezuela. We have a very common practice of holding detainees in absolute isolation with no access to a lawyer or even access to their families. Under Venezuelan law, people who are detained have the right to be brought before a judge within 48 hours, and that routinely does not happen. There have been many other cases. In particular, there was another lawmaker who was detained recently, and he's now been in isolation for 15 days.
Adriana Pichardo, you're an opposition lawmaker, and I'm wondering if you're concerned that you might be next.
Sí, mira, absolutamente. Tengo el miedo como un ser humano, pero
yes, I am afraid as a human being. I am human, so I am afraid. But I've also lived through other human rights abuses that are happening under this dictatorship. They came to my house some months ago and pressured and threatened my elderly mother, for example. But the worst fear is the fear that we would live under a dictatorship like this. And that's why we are fighting the government, and we have the support of God and the Venezuelan people to carry out that fight. They would like to scare us into silence, but we're not going to let that happen.
Adriana Pichardo, just one final thing before we go. I wonder if you're able to say just briefly how you're feeling at this point.
Perseguida y resistiendo ante los embates de una dictadura.
I feel persecuted, but resisting, putting up resistance to the threat of this dictatorship.
Adriana Pichardo is an opposition lawmaker in Venezuela. She's been speaking to us from Caracas. Adriana Pichardo, I want to thank you very much.
Muchas gracias a ustedes.
Almost 4 million Venezuelans have fled poverty and repression over the last 4 years. And with no end in sight for the crisis in Venezuela, the possibility of returning home is slim. Because even if a new administration takes over, it could take years for the economy to recover. In some places, the welcome for Venezuelan migrants is wearing thin. Take neighboring Colombia, now home to nearly 1.5 million Venezuelans. Journalist Manuel Rueda describes how this is playing out in his city, Bogota.
I was walking around my neighborhood here, and I met a young guy called Kelvin Rojas. He's 23. He was actually holding up some Venezuelan bills and trying to give them to people as a souvenir in exchange for a small donation. You know, he was basically begging in the streets with his child. And so what Kelvin says there is that while he's gotten help from some Colombians, other people that walk by or drive by just scream at him and tell him to go back home. They call him slurs. They've insulted him. So, you know, these people who are begging on the streets, which there are hundreds of Venezuelans doing this in Bogota now, do get, you know, the blunt end of the xenophobia.
I understand the Colombian government has been pretty generous in issuing temporary work and residency permits.
Yes, well, Colombia has had the attitude of trying to make the migrants legal as soon as possible. So Colombia has given Venezuelan migrants 2-year temporary residence permits. That's quite quick to get. And actually, according to authorities here, they legalized 400,000 people last year. They gave out 400,000 of these permits. So it still doesn't cover everyone. But, you know, for a country that has its own challenges like Colombia, it is quite a large amount.
So I understand those work permits are leading to some kind of resentment by Colombians in certain sectors of the economy.
Yeah, what you see in some sectors of the economy is that the influx of Venezuelans drives wages down a little bit. Of course, they also help some sectors as consumers. You know, for example, bus companies that bring people from the border into the interior of the country are doing very well now, thanks to the Venezuelan migrants. Or companies that send remittances are doing well. But also in some sectors, the influx of Venezuelans has driven down wages because it's competition, because Venezuelans work for less money. And that has generated worries among people who work in those sectors. So one of the people I talked to was Arnold Bonilla. He's a Colombian. He works in a barber shop in the center of Bogota, and here's what he had to say.
Sí ha afectado, y digamos que bastante, en el sentido de que hay menos oportunidades para ya para los colombianos.
So what Arnold is saying here is that the influx of Venezuelans has affected his sector. He's saying, you know, that in barber shops where he was working in another part of town before, Venezuelans were charging half of what a local barber would charge. So, you know, that's an aspect of the migration that worries him. He realizes that they're charging less because they're desperate to make money as soon as possible. The migrants who come here are desperate to send some money home to help their families. So it is creating concern among people in some sectors of the economy.
Yeah, for those Colombians who feel like they're being undercut by lower wages by Venezuelan migrants. I guess that's where the tension really is. But I understand that it's not a universal experience. I know you met a street musician from Venezuela. Let's hear him play a little. Manuel, who is this guy, and what did he tell you about his experience as a Venezuelan migrant in Colombia?
Right, so his name is Eric Sanchez. He's a 27. He was a classical musician in Venezuela. He plays the viola. And he, you know, every day now he gets together with four other classical musicians and they have a band. And they make money playing outside this fashionable shopping district in Bogota. So what Eric says is the following.
Podría decir que un 98-99% de las personas no han tratado excelente.
So he's saying there that, you know, 99% of people have treated him well and have supported him since he's been in Colombia. I think that this reflects something interesting, and it's that the higher skilled workers have an easier time integrating into a new country in general, I think. And this is also the case in Colombia. You know, Eric is a musician, he gives lessons, he plays in the streets, he does something that perhaps is pleasing to people, while, you know, folks like the first guy I spoke with, Kelvin, you know, he's begging, so he's doing something that for some people might be a nuisance. So I think that the experience of Venezuelans in Colombia has been mixed, but in general, you know, the higher skilled workers are having an easier time.
Manuel, what's your sense of how it's going for Venezuelans who've gone to other parts of South America as refugees?
Well, I think the experience has been similar in the different countries. Most countries in South America have been flexible with this issue of work permits, of helping people to integrate and to be there legally, not to be there underground, so to speak. But there has been violent cases of xenophobia as well. In Brazil, along the border, there was a case where a mob attacked a Venezuelan refugee camp. And that happened after a Venezuelan man was accused of robbing a local merchant. And something similar happened in Ecuador in January. Some mobs formed and started to ransack homes of Venezuelans after a Venezuelan man murdered a local woman. The woman was his girlfriend, so it was a very tragic situation. But, you know, basically, in cases where these immigrants have been accused of committing crimes, tensions seem to flare. Although, you know, the day-to-day experience is one where people are just integrating and trying to work and trying to get along.
Journalist Manuel Rueda in Bogota, Colombia. Thanks, Manuel.
Sure.
A quick note about another big news story we're following. Pope Francis issued a new Catholic Church law today. It requires clergy and other church officials to report sex abuse and cover-ups, and the church to investigate allegations internally. We called Marie Collins in Dublin, Ireland. She's an abuse survivor and advocate there, and this is her take on the new law.
It sets down very clearly all the procedures that have to be gone into, who's to report to who, how they are to do it, under what canons, etc. There's absolutely nothing in it saying what the sanction will be if they fail to do any of that.
We'll hear more from Marie Collins later in the show. Before Gangnam Style went global and BTS topped the Billboard charts, there was the Kim Sisters, America's original K-pop stars.
Like a road, but I show. We would like you all to meet from Korea, someone talented and sweet from Korea.
The Kim sisters were Sue and Ija and their cousin Mia. They made frequent appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show in the 1960s, but they got their start back home in Korea during the Korean War. The Kims' father was executed by the North as a prisoner of war, and the girls had to sing to support the family. They'd perform for American troops on the military circuit. The Kim sisters did not speak English at the time. They learned the songs phonetically. Kim Sisters doing Charlie Brown.
Why's everybody know what peeing on me?
We've got much more on the Kim Sisters at theworld.org. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Iran nuclear deal is on life support this week. Iran announced yesterday that it would pull back from that 2015 agreement. The U.S. withdrew from it a year ago and put tougher sanctions on Iran, but the rest of the signatories held on to the deal. Now Iran is giving those countries 60 days to make good on their promise to help Iran's economy. Today, France, Germany, the U.K., and the EU all rejected the ultimatum. Alastair Burt is a member of parliament in the U.K., but he was a minister of state last year and was in the talks when the U.S. left the nuclear deal.
The deal was designed to prevent Iran going for a nuclear option. that being the very worst possible outcome in a region which is already beset with conflict and difficulty. The signatories believed that stopping Iran going for a nuclear option was in the best interests of all. The United Kingdom and other partners still believe that even though Iran's activities in other areas need curtailing, and we're absolutely with the United States on that, we believe it's better to keep attempting to do that and to work with Iran while the nuclear deal remains in place, but the United States has changed its opinion. So we see the 60 days as Iran's inevitable reaction to the United States walking away and the increased pressure upon it.
But if you want to stay in the game with Iran, then why reject the ultimatum?
Well, we have always made very clear that Iran should abide by the terms of the deal. We are still in the deal. We haven't changed our position. So why should Iran? We are working to convey to the Iranians the importance of staying within the deal, because if they really do break it, and up to now they haven't, so long as the deal stays in place, this is something which protects us all.
If you had your druthers, would you have Iran sit tight, hang in with the agreement, and you and the other European signatories to the deal would do something to really relieve their pain with the sanctions and open up the kind of oil and banking sector?
To a point, yes. The problem of trying to devise an alternative financial mechanism to enable trade to continue is that so many of the world's financial structures involve the United States. It makes companies away from the United States but have dealings with the United States very wary. If they trade with Iran, then the United States will act against them. There is no way that the other partners can mitigate the overall effect on the economy that US sanctions has, particularly the sanctions on oil. What we would do is symbolically, by staying engaged, say to Iran, you do have partners, but in return for this, Iran has to recognize it. It needs to take some action too.
Alistair Burt, I wonder if you're worried. I mean, I wonder if you think the remaining signatories can work this out.
The short answer to your question is, I don't know. The consequences of Iran following through on its ultimatum, acting in breach of the agreement, which would cause the rest of the partners to leave the JCPOA, none of that helps the situation in the region. It doesn't change Iran's behavior. It puts it more into a corner. I don't think anyone in the region wants to contemplate a further war. Nobody wins wars now. All you see is massive damage to economies and to people over a lengthy period of time. But how do you descale the mutual threat that each feels? Don't think for a moment Iran does not itself feel under threat in the region, and it acts accordingly. But in doing so, it makes itself threatening to others. And we have to find a way to work through that.
Alistair Burt, member of the British Parliament and former minister with the UK's Foreign Office. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Let's get an entirely different take on Iran, an intimate, sentimental perspective. Our BBC colleague Golnoush Gulshani describes how she thinks about her hometown of Tehran.
Tehran smells of smoke and pollution, which you get used to a bit. But the homes smell of rice being cooked and fresh bread. So when you enter homes, one of those smells and immediately feel hungry. When I think about Tehran, I think about this street, which is called Vali Asr. It's said to be the longest street in the whole Middle East. It runs right through the middle of Tehran, from where Tehran meets the Alborz Mountains to the south. Tehran is not a very beautiful city. It's a very happening and exciting city to be brought up in, but it's not very beautiful. But this street is beautiful because it's got the sycamore trees on both sides, and in spring and summer, trees from both sides meet and form an arch. We have open streams of water running through alleys and streets. Snow melting from Alborz Mountain forms these rather wide streams of water running at the foot of the sycamore trees. When I close my eyes, or even with open eyes, when I think about Tehran, I think of this street. When you grow up in Tehran, an ideal weekend is to get out of Tehran. The huge Alborz Mountains right in the north of Tehran, this is something I extremely miss living in the UK, the view of the mountains. So an ideal weekend is to get up very early in the morning, meet with your friends around 5. We would hike for a couple of hours. By, you know, 9 or so, you get high enough to have a great view of the city. And then there are little cafes in the mountain where you can have fried eggs and what we call adasi, which is cooked lentils with several cups of tea. Sit and chat and then kind of leisurely walk back. I think I had my first kiss in a shared taxi. Have in mind that, you know, Iran is, you know, under Islamic Republic and still a rather conservative society. And 20 years ago when I went to university, boys and girls could not hang out in public, so you couldn't openly hold hands, not at all kissing in public. But I remember we were sat in a taxi and the driver could half see us in the mirror and he said, Astaghfirullah, which means I seek refuge to God. I left Iran 14 years ago to come and study journalism, and then I started working as a journalist. And I used to go back and forth, but since 2009 election and the protests afterward and the media coverage of the protests, especially the media outside Iran, the relationship between journalists working abroad and the government inside Iran has soured, so I haven't been able to go back. پشت کوها یه صبوره. I extremely miss Tehran, but I hold it dear in my mind and my memories. And I know that the Tehran that I remember is Tehran of 10 years ago, and it changes face every couple of years. So I know the Tehran that exists today is very different from the Tehran that I last visited.
The BBC's Golnoosh Gulshani sharing her memories of her hometown, Tehran, for the BBC podcast Fifth Floor, where international reporters share their feelings about the places they're from. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. Another missile test and a seized cargo ship. What's going on between the U.S. and North Korea?
I think both sides now are posturing their maximal demands, thinking that it's going to, you know, build leverage for them in that process. And instead, it's just undermining the goodwill that had been built up over the past year.
That story just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The U.S. announced today that it's seized a North Korean cargo ship for violating sanctions. The Justice Department said the ship was transporting coal, which is subject to a U.N. export ban. This is the first time the U.S. has seized a North Korean ship for violating international sanctions. The boat was impounded a year ago in April, but the announcement today came just hours after North Korea launched two short-range projectiles. Jenny Town is a Stimson Center Fellow and managing editor of 38 North, a policy journal about North Korea.
They do appear to be short-range ballistic missile tests. The one that happened last weekend seems to be a new model that we have not seen tested before. We don't have confirmation yet as to what was just tested last night, but it does appear to be probably the same missile. So these are showing greater capabilities in North Korea's continued development of their capabilities, especially against regional targets like South Korea.
Yesterday, I spoke with the State Department's top official on Iran, Brian Hook, and here's what he said about North Korea.
There is no question that the Korean Peninsula, we have lowered the temperature dramatically in North Korea. I mean, on the Korean Peninsula. That's just a fact.
Brian Hook seems to think that the U.S. is helping to lower the temperature in North Korea, but don't these recent tests suggest an escalation?
Certainly. Over the past year, the movement and the interaction between the two Koreas and the U.S. DPRK diplomatic process has lowered the tensions on the Korean Peninsula significantly. But it's not irreversible. And certainly measures like what we've seen over the past couple of weeks are counterproductive to the diplomatic process. They are raising the temperature. They are raising tensions. They shouldn't necessarily be surprising. You know, North Korea has been sort of warning South Korea against these kinds of measures, especially as U.S. and South Korea move to resume large-scale joint military exercises in less than a month.
Stephen Biegun, the U.S. Special Representative on North Korea, has arrived in Seoul to meet with South Korean officials. Talks with North Korea have stalled since the summit in Vietnam, since the failed summit in Vietnam, really. But you think there's a chance of bringing North Korea back to the table?
I think the door is still open. It won't stay open forever. And I do think it will be a little while before either side actually gets back to the table. I think the North Koreans are sort of recalibrating what their position is. I think both Washington and Pyongyang, you've seen especially the public messaging turn to a very hard line messaging. And so I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. But both sides are trying to put on the pressure to the other side to come back on more favorable terms. I don't think anyone wants to go back to the tensions that existed in 2017. But certainly there is a little bit of the post-Hanoi posturing that will be done before talks really resume.
Has the U.S. and South Korea been attempting to get North Korea back to the negotiating table by offers of food aid or anything else?
Both Washington and Seoul have been trying to get the North Koreans back to the negotiating table as quickly as possible. The problem is the proposition that they're offering to get them back has not changed.
And
you know,
what's
offering
that?
Food that North Korea must agree to complete denuclearization, and that until they do, that there's no room to negotiate on sanctions, that maximum pressure will be put back on, that we can't have a step-by-step process. These kinds of public messages, of course, are very unhelpful to getting the North Koreans to come back. I mean, what are they coming back for if they've already rejected this proposal over and over again? I think both sides now are posturing their maximal demands, thinking that it's going to, you know, build leverage for them in that process. And instead, I think it's just undermining the political goodwill that had been built up over the past year and can very easily escalate into something that builds the tension on the Korean Peninsula.
Jenny Town is a Stimson Center Fellow and the managing editor of 38 North. Thanks, Jenny.
Sure, no problem.
The Trump administration has been working on a proposal to solve the seemingly endless conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. The president has called it the deal of the century. But some experts are skeptical that the peace plan will ever see the light of day. Others think it's a terrible idea that's dead on arrival. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
Donald Trump wouldn't be the first American president to try to secure an enduring Middle East peace deal, but he is the first in many years who appears to have given up on the goal of Palestinian statehood. Even so, the administration says this is a good deal for the Palestinians. On her last day at the United Nations, Trump's ambassador Nikki Haley had this to say.
Both sides would benefit greatly from a peace agreement, but the Palestinians would benefit more, and the Israelis would risk more.
The deal of the century is the brainchild of Trump's son-in-law slash advisor Jared Kushner. For 2 years, Kushner has mostly been tight-lipped about what's in it. But late last week, he offered some hints during a talk in Washington, referring to the plan as an in-depth operational
document that shows what we think is possible and how the people could live together, how security could work, how interaction can work, and really how do you try to form the outline of what a brighter future could be.
Kushner doesn't talk about a two-state solution. He says the Trump administration wants to take a new approach, and soon. The Kushner plan is reportedly going to be unveiled in June, after the Holy Islamic month of Ramadan. Back in the Holy Land itself, there was another reminder of just how far from peace Israel and the Palestinians are right now. Over the weekend, fighting between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip killed at least 25 Palestinians and 4 Israelis. Negotiations between Israeli and Palestinian diplomats have been on hold for many months. Hussein Ibish with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington says the Trump administration has helped poison the atmosphere, starting with moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, cutting off funding for the Palestinians, and ending dialogue with their leaders. Now, Ibish says Kushner and his advisors are offering the Palestinians much less than what they've been seeking for decades.
They're treating the Palestinian National Movement as a bankrupt real estate venture to be liquidated at political pennies on the national dollar, and therefore they're not going to get the big things they want, like independence, freedom, statehood, citizenship, anything like that. What they can have is an economic incentive package, and then they will be told that their lives will improve as long as you don't mind living without rights and citizenship and a vote and all that stuff.
Kushner is reportedly depending on Arab Gulf states, including the Saudis, to finance the U.S. peace plan and provide economic aid to the Palestinians. Ibish says that's a fantasy.
There's every indication that Saudi Arabia is not going to pay for this, and more, that they're not going to even diplomatically push this because they are sure that it's a failed and a losing proposition that won't go anywhere.
It's just hard, given this administration's track record, to see any way in which this succeeds.
Michael Koplow is with the Israel Policy Forum in Washington.
This White House believes that land for peace has not worked. They tend to view the Palestinians as not being great partners, and they tend to accept Israel's most maximalist demands regarding security.
Koplow says Trump is popular with Israelis, especially those on the political right, and the president's vision seems to be in sync with Benjamin Netanyahu. The Israeli prime minister has talked about giving the Palestinians control over parts of the West Bank, but something much less than an independent state. But Koplow says few Israelis are enthusiastic about the Trump-Kushner peace plan.
You've had this funny scene in the last few months where a lot of the folks on the Israeli right have said, thank you, President Trump. We appreciate what you've done for us, but we don't want to see any peace plan from you. We're not interested.
Koplow says that's because those Israelis are in no mood to compromise with the Palestinians, which is something Kushner has said would need to happen. But some experts still doubt this deal of the century will ever see the light of day. Numerous deadlines for releasing it have come and gone. And maybe that's not such a bad thing, says Robert Satloff of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. At this point, Satloff says, President Trump needs to ask Jared Kushner one simple question about his peace plan.
Answer me truthfully. Is it a winner? If not, let's focus on something else.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
A groundbreaking effort to address sex abuse in the Catholic Church. That's what some people are calling a new church law that Pope Francis issued today. It requires clergy and other church officials to report sex abuse and cover-ups, and it requires the church to investigate allegations internally. Marie Collins in Dublin, Ireland, says the directive is a step in the right direction, but it falls short. She runs the Marie Collins Foundation, a charity focusing on child survivors of sexual abuse. Collins herself is a survivor of clerical sexual abuse. She says one problem with the new law is that it doesn't require church officials to go to the police.
Where it is mandatory to report, in other words, if it's a criminal offence not to report abuse to the civil authorities, then they are being directed to do so. But there's nothing beyond that, and I think that is an omission, because there's many countries in the world where it's not a criminal offence not to report. But we know from the past experience that this is what should be happening everywhere. The church should be reporting any cleric who sexually assaults a child to the local authorities.
Yeah, that's what stands out for me, is that the implication is that if individual churches report to the Vatican and through their bishop reports of alleged abuse, then it's up to church officials at the Vatican to investigate and determine?
That's right. And there's a section in it about the person who's been accused, everything being put to them and they having to make their defense. This is all internally within the church. And there's no warning whatsoever if civil authorities have been informed and there's going to be a criminal case, that there should be no internal investigation until the criminal case has been completed. Because by telling an accused person all the details before the police have time to interview them, you can interfere with the criminal case, and that's not here.
The Catholic Church says that having local priests or bishops report things to authorities would endanger the church in places where Catholics are a persecuted minority. What's your reaction to that?
I think, you know, most priests in a country will be natives of that country. They know their own laws. They know the laws of the country. I'm not sure why they should be protected from the law of the country. But in some cases, if it is to lead to any sort of persecution of Catholics because of an abusing priest, there may have to be exceptions. But that could be written in. There could be certain countries set aside.
One thing I don't understand is how the Vatican plans to enforce any of this. How does it make sure that local priests are reporting things?
Well, that is the other big gap in this particular document. There's absolutely nothing in it saying what the sanction will be if they fail to do any of that. And that has been the problem with the church all along, is accountability and proper sanctions being put in place.
It also seems to omit any discussion of punishment or what happens. I mean, say for the sake of argument that the church investigates a charge of abuse, then what?
That's right. It covers the reporting and it covers the investigation to a certain extent. It doesn't cover the outcome. It talks about the good name and the privacy of the people involved being kept confidential. That refers to the victim and the perpetrator. Anything in a church document to me which refers to protecting the good name of anybody really bothers me, because I think if someone is accused and they're shown to have abused, they're not entitled to a good name. Anyone found guilty of abusing a child should be expelled from the church. I think that's what most survivors want, and I think that would make a big difference to people if they saw the church expelling from their ranks anyone who had committed abuse against a child or a vulnerable person.
Marie Collins speaking with us from Dublin, Ireland. She works with child survivors of sexual abuse, and she herself is a survivor of sexual abuse by a priest. She previously served on the Pope's Commission on Child Protection. Thanks a lot, Marie.
Thanks, Carol.
A quick update on yesterday's election in South Africa. Results are rolling in, and the ruling party is on track for a victory.
This, for me, is like a rocket booster for democracy.
That's President Cyril Ramaphosa speaking at a polling station in Soweto yesterday. He's admitted that his party, the African National Congress, has made mistakes, especially when it comes to corruption. But he says he can turn things around for his party and his country. South Africa is struggling with serious economic problems like high unemployment, and basic services like electricity and water are unreliable. This voter, who spoke with the BBC, expressed his frustration with the ANC.
In the last 25 years, as you see now, the ruling party haven't done anything in the last 25 years. There are a lot of gangsterism around.
The ANC is the party of Nelson Mandela, and it's won every election since the end of apartheid. But it's clear the party has a lot of work to do if it wants to maintain that record going forward. Official results from yesterday's vote in South Africa are expected on Saturday. Across Russia today, there were military parades to mark the anniversary of Victory Day in World War II. In Moscow, thousands of soldiers marched in the rain to celebrate the day that Nazis were defeated in Europe. May 9th is a hugely important holiday in the countries that made up the Soviet Union. It commemorates a collective trauma, the end to 4 years of horrific struggle to drive out the German invaders. Some statistics may help you get a handle on this. Just over 400,000 Americans died in World War II. Soviet losses range from 20 to 27 million people.
We know there's a lot of unburied bodies to this day in places like Belarus and Russia and Ukraine.
That's writer Natalia Antonova. She was born in the Soviet Union and grew up there before moving to the U.S. She's since moved back and forth, but now lives in Washington, D.C.
In fact, my father used to tell me these stories about how he, as a child, would play in the woods by his mother's dacha, which is a summer house a lot of Soviet people had. And, you know, as a kid in the 60s, you could stumble on remains that were left unburied that no one even found because there were so many dead. Just the sheer number of bones. People are still finding them to this day all over this part of the world.
Every family in Russia and what was then the Soviet Union, I think, has a World War II connection. What family stories did you hear growing up?
Well, my grandfather fought in the Battle for Moscow. He defended Moscow. It was really funny because my grandfather, this is my mom's dad, fought in a particular division. And then my great-grandfather, who was Ukrainian, who was on my dad's side, fought in the same division. And I don't think any of these men could have imagined that eventually, you know, this guy's grandson and this guy's daughter would meet and fall in love. But this would happen in my family, for example. And my grandfather had a really cool military career after the fact and was a very well-respected, you know, celebrated man, I guess, in some ways. But he never liked to talk about the war. And I think it's true for a lot of the men from that generation. I think that it was not like a dinner time conversation topic at all.
I know you were born and you lived in Ukraine till you were nine. How was the war remembered when you were growing up?
Well, I think that when I was a child, I think people were closer to it in time then. You know, I'm pretty old at this point, I guess. I'm in my mid-30s. So I was definitely part of that generation that had this connection to the war that I think was very sad in a way. And while we obviously celebrated the victory and we performed the rituals of victory, I mean, I was taught from an early age that it was a horrifying thing and that, you know, there wasn't that sense of triumphalism that I think in particular exists in Russia today. But in Russia, you know, when I moved to Russia as an adult, as a journalist to go work there, I saw like a different trend, I guess, or a different political current that really, I don't know, I'm not going to say that they necessarily took away the tragic aspect of the war, but I do think that the current government in Russia has sort of co-opted that narrative and co-opted the experience of all these millions of people and what they went through because, well, I guess now, in a way that it wasn't in the Soviet Union, the memories of World War II in Russia serve as a kind of a way for social cohesion to still exist in this country. It's a very atomized society in many ways. People don't know their neighbors. People don't trust their government. But every year, May 9th, they can come together and remember the past. And I think that the Kremlin really does use it in a way that the Soviets, I think, did not. And people will probably disagree with me on this, but I really do see it that way, having experienced those two very different, I think, traditions of mourning and or celebrating the victory.
What is Putin's particular approach to May 9th? What does he kind of graft onto it?
They make it all about the pageantry, obviously, and you have to have a lot of pageantry associated with this particular day. And there's a lot of emphasis on military hardware. And there's a lot of emphasis on the fact that Russia can defend itself. And in a way, I think that Putin is really playing up to the collective post-traumatic stress that Russia, and in general, the post-Soviet world still has left over from the horrors of the 20th century. So not just the war, but also the terror and so on. I mean, it's my personal theory that I've been carrying around with me for years now. I think that our society, well, that particular society, which I am also part of in some ways, I think that it does have this collective PTSD. And I think the Russian government really plays it up.
Journalist and writer Natalia Antonova, she's currently an editor for Bellingcat in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Natalia.
Thank you.
Our interest in Russia is deep right now, and the world's Marco Werman is just back from a reporting trip there. But let's put politics and history aside for a moment and listen to this story Marco told us when he got back.
I'm in jet lag mode, and then you kind of get to that point where you're not really sure if you're ever going to fall asleep, and then I start hearing voices. It's kind of... Went back to sleep, and then, like, the next day, I was in the Moscow metro, and I heard the sound again. And I turned around, and there were probably a dozen women in these really colorful costumes, and they were wearing all the same kind of laminate badges that said International Acapella Festival Moscow 2019. And then it all came together. There's an International Acapella Festival in Moscow, and most of the contestants are staying at my hotel, practicing at 3 in the morning right across the hall from my room. I think maybe my favorite of everything I heard was this group from Siberia. It was a police choir, and they were doing Queen.
Magnifico! Oh, I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
I mean, it's a totally surreal experience, what I saw. I went to Russia thinking, well, there are all these examples of how people don't have freedom to express themselves. And yet, here was this international group of singers coming together, and they felt totally free to express themselves. So there was an interesting paradox there. In the stories on Russia we're going to bring you next month, I think some of these paradoxes are going to keep popping up. The kind of old systems of the former Soviet Union kind of coming to clash with a modern world.
The World's Marco Werman, jamming in Moscow and giving us a quick preview of the stories about Russia he'll have for you soon right here on The World. And that's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.